I was paying no attention to the title anyway. They asked me so long in advance that they ended up getting it randomly. So, good morning, good to be here again. I'm assuming I, once again, have not succeeded in efficiently offending you, and you're still prepared to invite me back. I'd like to look at various quite potent imagery that come from the Oron, perhaps the key utensil in the Mishkan and later the Beis HaMikdash. We'll begin by looking at the Kruvim. At least I should pay some lip service to the title. The Kruvim are very interesting. They are unique. And as you can see them in the verse Sisa Chapoiris of Tahorim Perichav Hey, you should make a lid of pure gold. It describes the dimensions, and then you have to extrude from it two Kruvim, a cherub on one side, a cherub on the other. They probably began with a little bit more metal at one at each of the ends, and then that metal was beaten out into the shape of the Kruvim. These Kruvim are very curious. It is not permissible to make any kind of form, any other situation, if the Kruvim were made detached from the Kaporis, if they're made from a different material, were they made in another place, these will be all synonym of Avodah Zorah. It seems to be sailing very close to the wind. Yet here it is a mandatory part of the construction of the Oron, and its imagery is extremely potent. I want to specifically settle all kinds of things one can say about it. The Rishonim have lots of materials. Sforna, the Ramban, Rabbeinu Bachya have all plenty to say about it. I particularly want to look at the imagery in the context of the Torah in general, because this is not the first time that we have met Kruvim. If one goes back to Parshas Bereishis, at the end of the story in Gan Eden, by Goresh Es HaOdom, and God expelled the man, by Ashken Mikedem LeGan Eden Es HaKruvim V'Es Lahat HaCherev Hamis HaPeches, and God caused to dwell there from the east of the Gan Eden the Kruvim and this shining sword, which is revolving, lishmoir es derech Eitz HaChaim, to guard the path to the Eitz HaChaim. And so it is quite impossible that the Torah will use the imagery of Kruvim in an inconsistent fashion, and therefore it seems obvious that some kind of connection needs to be made between them, and that will at least give us something which is associated with the title. The Rabbeinu Bachya, commenting on the construction of the Kruvim, on Pasuk Yud Ches here, which is the Pasuk of Osisa Shnei Kruvim Zahov, the Pasuk one should make the two Kruvim, says the Sorach Shetisa Boil B'Maimor, and one needs to examine carefully, to think carefully about this section, the way they are described. Hiva Kruvim Katsura Azul, Moshel Nimrot Lahaid Al Haflogos Hadvekus Shevein HaKodesh Baruch Hu Lisro, because the precise form is determined to represent the nature of the intense connection between God and the Jewish people, beloy shum en soi, with no kind of intermediary whatsoever. Ki hu yis'ale bodyam chenel Yisrael v'ein mo'ein nechor k'shal ha'olis galilim asher l'chok lehem sor mishal ma'alo. According to Rabbeinu Bachya, the Kruvim represent the fact that there is a unique relationship between God and the Jewish people of a direct nature, which is not paralleled by the way he runs the rest of the world and deals with his interactions with the other nations, where there is some kind of sar, some kind of, how do you want to translate sar, some kind of a ministering angel, some kind of ideology, how do you want to read it, through which he communicates and deals with them. The Kruvim represent, they look at each other. We know that there are plenty of, we'll read a couple of Gemaras before returning to my question about Gan Eden. My Kruv, what is a Kruv? Says Gemara in Sukkah, Daf Hei on Vase. Omri Be'abahu Karabia. Kruv is read sort of as Kruv Karabia, which means a child. She came above her because in Babylon, Koirin Linu Karabia, a child was called a rabia. These are the faces of children. They represent innocence. They represent this concept. And they look at each other closely, as we can see. Omra Katina Gomor and Yumadaf Nun Daladol Aleph. Bishasho Yisrael Oilim Laregel. When Yisrael came to the Beis HaMikdosh for Yomtuf, Agal Mohem Es HaPoroiches, it was never permitted except for the Kohen Gadol or Yom Kippur to go inside the Kodesh Kodoshim, but they rolled back the Poroiches, so it was possible for people to peer in. Umarilohim as Akruvim, and they showed them the Kruvim. This must be referring to the Bais Rishon, because in the Second Temple era there was no Oren. Show Ma'urin Zebel there, and they were hugging each other, these Kruvim. They represent this Dveikus. This is followed by the Rebbeinu Bachya, which we saw already. It represents this Dveikus, this relationship between God and the Jewish people. Va'orim Lohem, and those who were showing the people would say, hey, look at this. Ru'u chibaschem lifnei hamokam. Kechibas zochor v'nokeivo. Look at the dear nature of your relationship between you and God. It's just like the relationship between a male and female. It goes without saying, there is some quite significant intimate imagery here. The Kruvim are understood to be one male, one female. They are seen as hugging each other. And it is not coincidental that this is the place in the world, the Kodesh Kodoshim, where God, as it were, and the Jewish people meet. The place where this world warps into the next world, where the physical and spiritual touch in the most tangible way, is that space in Bein HaKruvim, the space between the Kruvim. And it's hardly surprising, therefore, there's some quite what might call sexual imagery of the male and female connecting in this way, cuddling and hugging. And it's interesting as well, more well known, come on, Baba Basra. It refers to the fact that there appears to be a contradiction. Are they Fnein Ish El Chiv? Are they facing each other? Or are they Pnehem Labois? Or are they facing the walls away from each other? From which the Gemara understands. They hug each other when the relationship is going well, when the Jewish people are fulfilling God's will, and they face away from each other when they're not fulfilling God's will. And it seems that this is to represent, as the Rabbeinu Bachya says, it is a relationship without any kind of intermediary. The possibility of man connecting to God directly without any kind of other means. Now, if one looks into one or two of the more obscure Chazalim, one can find a precedent for the way we're going to see the Rav Hirsch reads the connection between the Kruvim on top of the Oren in our Parsha and the Kruvim I mentioned already back standing outside Gan Eden. I'm going to use two sources here. Just to point out before I do that the normal reading of the Pasuk in Bereishis is that Adam, and by extension the whole of humankind, has had an opportunity to connect to God in the most profound and direct way. He can live in paradise. He has no worries of the physical world. He lives in an intense experience, and he's messed up. And now he's going to have to acquire that through the processes of history by his own efforts. He's expelled from Gan Eden. He doesn't completely lose his connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But what he's expected to do is to go out into the world and recreate through the vicissitudes of history, the relationship with God that was given to him on a plate, what is called the intimate relationship. He couldn't cope with the Nahama Daksufa, this bread of shame, as the Zohar calls it. It means he's given everything on a plate, the relationship is there for him, he hasn't earned it. Instead, the underlying perhaps motive of the chet itself is he wants very much what he has, but he wants to acquire it through his own efforts. He goes out into the world, and the reason the Kruvim are there is because that is the new world that Adam and Chava have chosen for themselves, and he can't just go back and say, no, I've changed my mind, I'd like to be in Gan Eden again, I'd like to be close to the Eitz HaChayim, I'd like to be there right by the source of life and drink from it without any kind of problems. You can't do that anymore. And the simple reading of the Pasuk is Lishmoyer es Derech Eitz HaChayim, to guard it, to stop man from going back there, because he's now created a history and a future for himself which does not allow him to connect in such a direct way. That's a simple and normal understanding. Now, the Talmud of Be'er Yohu says on this pasuk, "Vayashkein mikedem nagalei zakuvim mila." The gods put to the east of Gan Eden these kruvim. Melamed shakruvim koid min lemaisa voracious. Mikedem means from before. They were somehow or other there before Bereishis. There was something built in to the divine plan. You shouldn't understand it means they were somehow sitting there before anything else came into existence. But it means they existed notionally in the divine thought as a precursor to creation. They have to be there if they're somehow part of the blueprint of creation. And similarly, This is the revolving shining sword. This refers to Gehinnom. We'll leave that. What's Lishmoir as Derech, to guard the Derech? Eitz Hachayim, Ein Eitz Chayim Ela Torah. This is a very obvious imagery. Eitz Chaim Hina Machazikim Bo. Now, the image of Eitz Chaim is always Torah. It's a tree of life to those who grasp it. Eitz Chaim doesn't just mean the Eitz Chaim, whatever that was in the Gan Eden, somehow the source of life, that there's a concern man will come and take from the fruit and he'll live forever, whereas immortality is now denied to him following the sin. Eitz Chaim has two meanings, but of course they really are the same meaning, because the source of all life, the life-giving force in this world, is the Torah. And the ability for man to connect to God happens through the Torah. So you see here straight away that there is a connection made the time of Eliyahu, that the next time we see the Kruvim, they're Kruvim sitting over the Torah. And we already had here Kruvim and Torah connected together. That theme is expanded. There's a Medrash in there, which is part of the Zohar, but it's easier than it sounds in the introduction. Rabbi Bo, the shame Rav Huna Omer, Kivish Chota Odom. Once Adam sinned, the Gozu Olov Oisna Gezeris, and all these decrees which we read in the Parsha of Bereishis were made against him. The Shua Kodesh Boruch Moisna Nois, they do him Sholoi Ba'eden. God expelled him and denied him all the pleasures, both physical and spiritual, I suppose, that he had in the garden. Umina Shoimrim Lashari Gan Eden, and he appointed guards to the gates of Gan Eden, Umihem, and who were they? What were they? Hakruvim, the cherubs, as the Pasuk says already. Kidei lishmoir oisa haderech v'apesach, in order to guard this way and this opening. Shav nigzar, because then it was decreed, shleyeh rushus t'cholos and become the eilech, l'konish shom. Well, no, people were not given permission. Not everyone had permission to go back on this route. Zulasi, except for those souls, those people who have first been refined by these kruvim. This is a reading in Chazal which says the kruvim as well are protecting it. They're not preventing you from access, they're only allowing limited access. Those who access whatever these texts mean, as they are, so we don't necessarily understand all the layers of meaning, but the kruvim means some kind of concept. It means if we are able to pass the kruvim test, if we have gone through some kind of process, then we are allowed to get it. And the kruvim are not to stop everyone from coming in, they're to stop the wrong people from coming in. If the kruvim determine that this soul is fit to enter, let him come in, but im lav, those who are chutz. And if not, then he gets thrown outside and burnt by the revolving sword. So we're beginning to see that there is a relationship. Rav Hirsch puts it beautifully, actually in his commentary on Bereishis, not here. Lishmoir es eret derech eitz hachayim can mean to protect, not to guard or to prevent, but to protect the way to the tree of life, so that man shall not find it. But it can also mean to protect and preserve the way, so that it shall not be lost for mankind, so that he will be able to find it again, and ultimately go back to it. Kruvim always appear as the bearers of the glory of God, revealing itself to mankind, intervening in human affairs. Kruvim protected the tree of life in the rejuvenated temporary paradise. The Mikdash, how do they describe it? The Gan Eden. Gan Eden in the real world is the place of Mikdash, the place where man and God connect. And the means by which man will connect to God and return to Gan Eden is, of course, the Torah. So the pshat in the phrase Lishmoir es derech eitz hachayim is to guard, to preserve, to keep it there. And when next time you see Kruvim, God will say, this is the path back. That's why the sources, and we can read a little bit more about Hish in a minute, that's why the sources understand that the opening of the Mishkan was the end of a process that began in Gan Eden. There's a Medrash Rabbah which says that the first stage was the Chet in Gan Eden, and the Shechina moved one stage from the world, and then Kain another stage, and so on till you get to the generation of Avraham Avinu, where the Shechina has retracted into the seven heavens and is as far as the world from the world as it can be. Avraham comes into the world and brings it down a little, and Yitzhak a little, and so on. And by the time you get to the generation of Moshe Rabbeinu, the Shechina has reached level 6, but it is not yet living in this world. on the opening of Vayhi by Yom HaShmini, on the eighth day, when the opening ceremony of the Mishkan, the Shekhinah is brought back into this world. This means the Mishkan represents all the things that Gan Eden was supposed to be. Of course, it's only microcosm, because we live in an imperfect world, and until the tikkunim from that process that began in Gan Eden have been completed, this will not fill the entire world. It's well known, according to some Rishonim. Seems to be the reading of the Sforna, and maybe of the Ramban as well. That had there not been a Chetah Egel, I mean, had Klal Yisrael remained on a certain level, there would be no need for the Mishkan at all, because it would be impossible for man to experience God everywhere, rather than have to limit it to a small space, the Mishkan. So we see here that the relationship between the original Kurban is God throws man out of Gan Eden and says, you're going to do it on your own now. You're going to have to go through a path, a torturous path of history. It will involve sometimes the most beautiful and sublime experiences that perhaps you couldn't have achieved without having left Gan Eden, but it's also perforce going to involve tremendous pain, challenges, and sometimes facing the inscrutable and inexplicable. But when you see the Kruvim on the Oren, you will know that you're going back in the right direction. And so the pshat is lishmoy the derech etachayim, is that God is going to set the world up in such a way that there will be a route back. And the Torah, this idea of man being able to connect to God directly, the rabbia, the two children hugging each other, this quite intimate and passionate imagery, that is the image of the relationship between the Kodesh Baruch Hu and Klal Yisrael, a relationship that existed in its, if you like, in its early form in Gan Eden, between Adam and Kodesh Baruch Hu, and a relationship that can only be recreated. Adam can only get back to Gan Eden using the means of the Torah. And that, if you like, brings the two together. And that is the beginning part of the Shir, the route back to Gan Eden. So that's part one. And I'll share with one or two other ideas as well, also related to the Oren. I recommend, as it's hardly you liked reading, but in Parshas Truma, the Malbim has a second commentary, has his main commentary, which is really based on the Machilta, and he has a second commentary which is printed below that, called Rinzei HaMishkan. The Rinzei HaMishkan is a really a lengthy essay on the whole purpose, function, and subdivisions of the Mishkan, and it's based, I believe, on an idea that he got from the Bahir, which is one of the early Sifrei Kabbalah. And the idea is that human beings are called Olam Koton. We are the world in microcosm. But he says it follows, given that human beings are intended to be the achievers of the ultimate purpose of creation, which is to bring Shekhinah into this world, to create a place for Kodesh Baruch Hu to live in our world. The other started this process. You may be familiar with the introduction of the Rambam to Sefer Shemos, in which he explains that the Bereishis is about the spiritual achievements of a family, of the Ovis, and how the scene switches at the beginning of Shemos to the national life, and all those spiritual achievements of the Ovis are now going to be replicated in the life of the nation, and that is achieved when the Mishkan is filled with the Divine Presence, which are the clothing lines of Sefer Shemos. What is going to happen is that just as human beings at a small scale in the life of the Ovis in Bereishis, so too on the national level of the Jewish people, because the universe is an Olam, is an Odom Godol. The universe is the great, is a reflection of the great human being, and he uses this amazing moshel in the Malbim in his introduction. He describes as he has two, he might, two musical instruments, let's call them lyres, that's what he uses. You have a small lyre and a big lyre, and if you play music, he says, on the small lyre, what happens then is the big lyre then plays bigger music and more wonderful music in correspondence. If you play horrible music on the lyre, then you get horrible discordant music on the big lyre. His moshel is understood as follows. If human beings perform their job properly in this world, that means we live our lives in accordance with the instructions, Torah and mitzvahs, then the universe reverberates with those achievements and all the spiritual lights come on. And if we fail, then we bring death and destruction not just to ourselves, but also to the whole universe, because there is an intimate relationship between the Odom Cotton, the small human being, and the Odom God, or the great human being. So he explains, however, that once you get to a national level, then you have a problem, because we don't have the exalted souls of the Ovis. We have instead just a tiny fraction, a tiny spark millions of people, each with a tiny spark, altogether capable of achieving what the others achieved, but not individually. He said there's not enough with one or two people, or even a few thousand people, to be able to draw the Shekhinah into this world, and therefore turn the lights on in the whole universe. So what the Kodesh Baruch Hu says is that you have to have a project, and this project harnesses all the spiritual capacity of every Jew, and then when working together, this is called Mishkan, and later Beis HaMikdash, and then if everyone works together, then the light comes on in the Mishkan, then we're back to the situation of the era of the Ovis, and that in turn affects the whole universe, and the music starts playing all around the world, as it were. You have to imagine that if you have an aerial view of the Mishkan, and it was constructed of tiny pinpricks of light, each pinprick in itself is minuscule, but if they all light up together, you have this blazing light which lights up the whole universe. That's pretty much how he says it, but I'll put it into a slightly more modern idiom. So he says, therefore, it follows that the Mishkan is also representation of the human being, because it represents the corporate identity of the Jewish people, a human being, if you like, composed of the small contributions of millions and millions of other human beings. That is, if you like, he says, it takes about 3 pages to say that. Of course, it has many nuances that I haven't mentioned. But what he does say is that, therefore, every part of the Mishkan, not just its shape, not just its dimension, but even the individual utensils within it, represent some part of the human body. So, for example, he says the Oren is the brain, and he describes in detail as he goes through it how the Oren represents the brain. He says that the Mizbeach and all of its utensils represent the digestive organs. He goes through a whole description of peristalsis, how the digestive system works, and how each part of the human, each part of the Mishkan, corresponds to some aspect of the digestive process, and so on and so forth. The point of this introduction, and in the kind of remaining few minutes that I have, is to see that when we examine the Mishkan, we now have a completely new dimension. Every part of the Mishkan, every facet of its construction, is intended to tell us something about how we're supposed to behave ourselves. Because if that's how it is in the Odom Godel, the Mishkan, the great corporate representation of the human being, this is how it also has to be in the smaller human being as well. And we're supposed to be learning from it. So in that vein, I want to share with you a small idea. The construction of the poles of the Oren. Now, there is a, as the Gemara in Yuma recalls, there is a biblical prohibition of removing the poles from the Oren. Lo yosum menu, you're not allowed to take the poles away from it. And so the Gemara explains, well, how, what do they do then? Right? How do they? Misparkin v'ein shmotin. That's the Gemara in Yuma. And Rashi explains, how are the poles constructed so that they didn't fall off or be removed? Misparkin. Roshem ha'yo ovin. The ends of the poles were thick. The hichnis roshin erkod b'doke, and they forced the end of the pole through the rings that were attached to the side of the Oren. And uben soin hoyudokin, but in the middle the poles were thinner. Hilkach loya hoyun is chokin, therefore they couldn't move, the tabois. Elam, they were jammed onto the pole. So although they were forced on originally, maybe they made the ring a little wider and then closed it round afterwards, either way they forced it in, it was not possible. But it did mean, of course, that it would slide around in the middle. You have to imagine it was thinner in the middle, and it was thicker at the end. So there was a certain flexibility. There was a certain movement that was possible, but of course when it moved nearer the edge, it couldn't go any further, because the end of the material was thicker, and that's how it was constructed. Any more details, it's quite straightforward, and this is a well-known Rashi. The point of this is that this is absolutely fundamental to the processes of transporting the Oren. The poles, according to other sources, were placed in this way, actually there the whole time, so they were all ready for action. If you took the poles out and it was some kind of emergency, then you've got to start fumbling around and finding the poles. It takes too long. The Oren is so valuable, it's so precious, you can't risk leaving it behind. If there's an attack, you've always got to be able to move it. So again, Rav Hirsch, and then I'll add my own gloss to this. The Badim, the carrying poles of the ark, symbolize, it is Israel's purpose and mission to carry the ark and its contents away, if need be, from one place to another. That's already, because they have to carry it. The origin of the Torah, you've got to be able to pick the Torah up no matter what circumstance, no matter which era, no matter which type of milieu you live in, you've got to be able to pick it up and take it with you. Because if you leave it behind, then there's no Torah and Judaism is over. The specification that the carrying poles must never be absent from the ark confirmed from the beginning and for all time to come the basic concept that this law and its function are not confined to the soil on which the temple and its sanctuary stand at any given time. Rather, the law is ready at all times to accompany the people of Israel wherever their God may lead them. Wherever they may have to travel, it is their mission to take their God-given law with them and to build a home for it in their own lives, seeing in the preservation of this law the sole guarantee of their own survival, and to be bearers of the glory of God wherever their destiny will find them. I'll take it a stage further. The only reason it's possible to pick the Oren up is because of this flexibility. If the poles were not so flexible, there was a certain movement, the poles would snap. It may well be end up leaving the Oren behind. I found in something I wrote myself, I wasn't going to admit having written this, but here we go. The nature of the carrying poles educates us as this how is to be done, making sure that wherever we go, no matter what history, where in history, we can take the Torah with us. Remember, they were thick at the ends and thinner in the middle, enabling the Oren to move about on them without ever falling off. This teaches the critical concept of the need for flexibility within certain boundaries. The Torah itself has many different valid expressions, corresponding to the different positions that the Oren could occupy on the poles. In some societies, such as possibly ours, a whole different range of types of Judaism were required, all sitting comfortably next to each other, because the idea of flexibility is fundamental to the survival of Judaism. The Oren could only be carried to its next destination. Wherever we have gone, we hope that we will be here for a very long time, but we never know, and our history indicates that that's not actually that likely. And wherever we have to go next, we've got to be able to pick it up and take it with us. Sometimes we see what I would describe, now I'm getting myself into trouble in the last 2 minutes, a certain type of shtetlization, in which a certain kind of experience, a certain type of social background, a certain type of socio-economic historical circumstance is viewed as the optimum place in which Judaism is to be observed. There is only one, and that is in Eretz Yisrael in the time of the Beis Hamikdash. That is the only optimum way in which Judaism can be observed. All others are bidyeved. All others are bidyeved by definition. And if we tie our Judaism in our mind to a certain type of set of circumstances, socio-economic situations, modes of dress, or whatever it happens to be, then we risk being incapable of transporting it. We saw in previous generations wholesale abandonment of Judaism, possibly because of this. It becomes tied to certain set of circumstances. The sense of portability and flexibility is lost. Of course, there are parameters. There's only a small amount of flexibility on the rings. It moves a little bit, but not too much. There are a range, but there's only so far. There are things which are not part of the system. This doesn't mean anything goes, but it means there's a bit more flexibility than many people who work within the system might be prepared to admit. I'm not going to go any further, you know exactly what I'm saying. And so I would like to invoke the Malbim's Rinzau Mishkan based on the Bahir to understand that if the Oren is made like this, it is valid to draw a direct message about the way we are supposed to conduct ourselves. We're supposed to divorce our Yiddishkeit from specific socio-economic circumstances to ensure that wherever we are, whoever we are, and wherever we go, we can always take it with us. Have a good day.